Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 112.
This week on the podcast, after a four-year hiatus, Americans pretend to be nice and cozy with soccer terminology once again.
Iraqi insurgents fail to respect that the U.S. already solved all the Middle East peace problems by declaring the mission accomplished.
And the GOP's uncoziness with math leads to the greatest political upset in American history. And no, we're not overselling that.
This week on Hillary Pillory, Clinton better be glad we'd invented a term for Romneying before she started her book tour.
And Terry Gross and Obama both give the gays a Pride Month gift to remember.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Do it.
You should do that.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
You should be one of the people on Earth that pretends like soccer is interesting.
Apparently, right now, that's what there is to do right now. That's what we're doing.
That's what you do.
That's it.
I am one of these people who, as you know, love sports.
Yes.
And every 4 years, the World Cup rolls around, and I get really excited about it, and then watch 10 minutes of soccer, and then remember that I don't like soccer.
No, that's what people are doing.
That's what people
do. You're not the only one out there who's up to that.
But, well, a lot of people do a better job at pretending than me. But what I will say is that this World Cup has been very interesting so far, because, like, and this sounds like a dumb thing to say, but, like, the problem with soccer for me is that nothing ever happens.
This is interesting coming from someone who loves football so much.
But
that was just a thought. Continue what you were saying.
Fair enough. But, I mean, like, it seems like, especially, like, in these first-round games where, like, you can actually have ties and, like, get points for ties, and then it's, like, because they're in groups and, like, the top two teams get out of, like, their group that they're in and stuff like that. So, like, they don't go into penalty kicks, they don't go into overtime or anything like that. So, like, I just find that, like, the first part of the World Cup always, like, gets me so disinterested because, like, you watch, like, 10 games that, like, end in a 0-0 tie and you're sort of like, all right, like, well, just listen. Wake me when something important is happening because it's not right now,
it's
obviously.
True. Soccer is, I would argue, more exciting on a minute-by-minute basis and way less exciting on a win by loss basis.
Sure, fair enough. But people have been scoring in this World Cup.
Yes.
There's been like goals. There's only been one tie in the entire first pass of games, and it was today. It was Iran and somebody, I don't know, Ecuador, I think maybe. That might also be right or wrong. No, it's not. Germany beat Ecuador, I think.
All right.
I don't know. It doesn't matter.
Why not?
Regardless. But like there have been like 3-2 games, there's been 4-1 games, there's been come from behind games. There was even a game the other day where that had basically like a buzzer beater, which doesn't happen in soccer. Like you don't see that. Like somebody scored with like 20 seconds of stoppage time left.
Stoppage time
is that miscellaneous time that gets added to the end of the game that is totally arbitrary.
How everyone suddenly knows a lot of soccer terminology during the World Cup. Terminology that no one has ever used in real life ever.
Yeah.
The whole office was abuzz with soccer terminology today. They had the World Cup on an extra computer.
It was on our TVs too.
I could hear it from other offices. I could hear people screaming.
Yeah.
It was, I guess, very exciting. Yeah. I don't know.
But America won today.
Yeah. And we beat Ghana, who we never beat, because they're always knocking us out of the World Cup.
And they knocked us out. And we're supposedly in the group of death or something clever that people are calling it.
Because
Germany's in it, and they're really good, and Ghana is usually pretty good, and Portugal's in it,
who's
usually pretty good.
These are all places where people like soccer watch soccer.
Exactly.
So people are excited about having a good soccer team.
I mean,
whereas here, we just sort of like have... what's interesting about soccer here, because I was thinking about this the other day when the World Cup was starting, is soccer here is really an elite sport, which it's not anywhere else in the world, because it's one of the simplest sports to have the equipment for.
And that's why you end up seeing places like Costa Rica win a soccer game at the World Cup, or Ivory Coast win a game at the World Cup.
Because like, every kid over three is playing soccer
in that
country.
If you have a ball and a couple posts, you're good to go.
I mean, you have a soccer game,
right?
Right. It's even less equipment required than basketball,
right?
Which is sort of
or
our
baseball.
Equivalent sport that every kid, you know, in a city or wherever is playing basketball. And you know, we have a very sort of like urban suburban dichotomy between like what sports people play. But one thing that we're pretty consistent on is the only people that play soccer seriously in the U.S. are upper middle class and white.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And they go to these fancy camps and they're in these fancy leagues and it's all very fancy. But it's not really a sport for the masses the way it is everywhere else in the world. In any case, continue talking about how wonderful the World Cup is because I have not been watching, so
well,
I can't.
Our game was great because we scored in the first 30 seconds, which was very bizarre. So everybody was like immediately freaking the fuck out.
Right.
And then Ghana tied it up toward the end of the game, and everybody was like, oh, shit, well, it's going to be a tie.
Right.
Which wouldn't have been, like, the worst thing in the world, but, like, also not
what
we wanted.
The best
and
thing.
Then we scored in, like, the 86th minute or something. There's 90 minutes plus stoppage time,
right.
me using soccer terms.
Plus a soccer term that Brent knows.
So we won 2-1, which is great. So it's still going to be hard to get out of that group. We're going to have to get out with Germany. So that means we'll probably have to beat Portugal. But Germany is serious business, and they're probably not going to get beaten by anybody in that group after they just destroyed Portugal.
I don't see us as World Cup winners.
No, I don't think that we are. I think that a lot of people, I mean, I was listening actually on my way into work this morning. They had on NPR, they were interviewing some guy from the BBC who was sort of like talking about, you know, whatever. And the guy was like, what would be like a good result for the US to have? And he said, he was like, it would be massive for them to get out of this group. So I think that if they're able to do that, like, that's fine. But you're right. I mean, like, then they're still in the quarterfinals. Like, they're not going to win the World Cup. Our coach has said that we're not going to win the World Cup.
We're not those people.
That's not who we are.
It's just not who we are as Americans.
No.
We're not World Cup winners.
No.
But they've obviously been having massive protests as well in Brazil, which started before the World Cup and have continued.
Yes.
And are getting excited from the police end.
Yeah.
Getting exciting from the police end because there's a lot of very active riot gear style, you know, rubber bulleting and such going on.
Well, you know, I mean, we talked about it, I think, like months ago, basically, when they were sort of like, you know, finishing up some, or not finishing up, but sort of like really in the heat of sort of, you know, getting some of these stadiums built and things like that, because I think it's costing them something like $11 or $12 billion. Yeah. And in 2 years, they have the Olympics, which is going to cost God knows how much money. So,
the going rate right now is $51 million. Right. Billion.
Right. And the Brazilians, you know,
don't have that cash to spare.
Right. They don't have that cash to spare. And some of them are mad that they don't, you know, have
roads,
basic services,
schools,
exactly.
A non-corrupt police force that you can call on in a time of need.
Right, exactly.
So a country where the talk of the nation isn't always how violent and terrifying it is.
So you can imagine why they might be protesting the government spending billions and billions of dollars that they don't have.
Brazil's current situation, I think, raises a lot of important questions about whether whether it's worth it for developing countries to host these big international sporting events.
Yeah.
Because it ends up being a huge financial burden on the nation. And it's one thing, you know, London can make it happen. China can probably make it happen, even though they're sort of technically in the developing world, because there's like a zillion of them and they have a lot of money sort of centralized.
Right.
But a country like Brazil, where, you know, services are lacking and where the government has really made a turn to the left and has been trying to address some of these issues, but is coming up against, I mean, there's a lot of issues there. So they're coming up against sort of like a massive mountain of problems.
Yeah.
Whether countries like that, whether it's beneficial for them to agree to host these things, because it just ends up being a drain on their resources. And then you can have what happened even in Athens. You know, I was in Athens during the Olympics. The Olympics cost them zillions and zillions of dollars. It was really nice in Athens for the months after the Olympics, and then shit fell apart real fast.
Right.
And it was because they ran out of money.
Yeah.
And like, what are you going to, you know.
Yeah, that's what happens.
That's what happens when you spend a lot of money, is you run out of it eventually.
Yep.
I wish that weren't true.
I know.
That would change the way I live my life. That were not the case.
Totally.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the rest of the world is falling apart anyway.
Oh,
despite
my gosh.
Our show of soccer camaraderie.
Right. It's like we're living in 2003 all over again.
Iraq is just in the shitter.
Big time. That's as good as anyone's put it, I think, probably. Any pundit anywhere.
Yeah.
It's in the shitter.
Basically. So, and they've had sort of, you know, little bits of this issue in the past, as we all know.
Yeah.
There's a rebel group that's out to take control of Iraq. They're called ISIS, which stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It's a Sunni organization that is also operating in Turkey.
Yeah.
And Syria. And they're basically trying to carve out a Sunni state, a radical Sunni state.
Right.
Not like some nonsense Sunni state, like, oh, we just,
like
you know.
Like some sort of like secular Sunni state.
We don't feel
state,
welcome like a, here in the Shia state. We want our own state. Like, this is like some scary nonsense. And obviously, Iraq is a majority Shia country, but under Saddam, it was being ruled by this sort of Sunni ruling class.
Well, and so they were also, it was a Sunni ruling,
about,
it was a Sunni ruling class, but it was also sort of like, it was fairly secular.
Right, it was a fairly secular Sunni ruling class.
Right, and that's what I think, you know, I mean, we'll get into sort of like what's going on specifically, but I think it's interesting that, you know, I mean,
This is sort of retaliation for something that was never religiously.
Well, right. I mean, we can sort of like say what we want about Saddam Hussein and sort of, I mean, I know that, you know, we've already sort of like rehashed all the reasons why we went in there and shouldn't have gone in there and all these things. But what is so interesting is that Saddam Hussein didn't really love these terror groups any more than anybody else did. I mean, he was his own brand of like crazy and evil, but like he was also sort of like running.
He was not a fundamentalist.
He was running Iraq in a way that would not have been friendly to a group like this.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think what's interesting about the situation is that my current understanding of the Middle East has benefited greatly from going to Lebanon a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Because what I learned there was that many of the political alliances in the region are sort of religiously based, but in a very political way. Mm. So, like, people would ask you what your religion was, but they were really asking what party you belonged to. And they didn't really understand American politics as a, you know, conceptually as a place where, like, me and Brent could be part of the same party, because me and Brent are not the same religion,
right.
You know? And, like, Brent and I are aligned on almost every political point, except for a very, like, minor amount of theology.
Right.
But we would not belong to the same party in the Middle East. So, like, this is a place where it's sort of difficult for, it's, you know, when you're, like, when you have these sort of terror groups that are masquerading as, you know, religious groups or whatever, it's sort of difficult for people, I think, to make the call between how much terror is too terror and, like, what is an organization that's representing their interests.
Right.
Which is what's made this challenging.
Yes.
Because, so, ISIS took control of a bunch of cities in the north, and they're sort of working their way steadily down to Baghdad.
Right.
They've
taken control of, like, some of the, like, the second largest city behind Baghdad.
Exactly.
I mean, they're not just sort of, like, you know, taking over, you know,
rando cities. They've taken a bunch of oil-rich cities. They've taken the second largest city.
They have a plan, is what I was meaning to say.
Exactly. The press has sort of been framing this as a very, like, Sunni versus Shia thing, and it's a little bit more complicated than that. It always is in Iraq because of the Kurds. The Kurds are up to shenanigans always. Everyone hates them, but they hate everyone, and it's sort of like they're always in the middle. So there's an issue with the Kurds, who may end up sort of benefiting from this instability because they're, like, sort of slightly allied with ISIS, but not really. And then there are a bunch of other groups that are sort of, like, unaffiliated and are kind of freelance terrorizing around the country.
Right. And this ISIS group is, like, crazy because, like, they're
crazy pants.
They're too bonkers for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, they were a splinter group from Al-Qaeda.
Right, and Al-Qaeda has disowned them.
Yeah, Al-Qaeda renounced them.
Yeah.
In February.
Right.
So they've been in the makings of Crazy Town for a while now.
Yeah.
But they're social media savvy, so they've been doing a lot of shit talking on the internet.
Yeah. Well, and they posted, I think, just as of today, like, they had, like, posted, like, a mass shooting, basically, of a bunch of people that they had taken prisoner.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, they're not just, like...
They're not sorry.
They're not just posting web videos where they are stating their intentions. I mean,
they're using social media in a much more active way than a lot of these other terror groups have.
Yeah.
Because they're documenting their successes.
Right. It's not just a message from someone in a cave somewhere with a webcam. Like, that's not...
No, they're up on Twitter shit-talking.
Yeah.
Is what they're doing.
Yeah.
Their doctrine is insane. It's very, like, women never go outside and, you know, the usual.
Well, and I think in the cities that they've been taking over, like, I think, you know, there have been reports of, like, women who have committed suicide because they were, like, raped and then, like, forced into, like, marriages with these people who basically, like, took over the cities and they didn't want any part of it, basically. So, like, they're really sort of, like, I mean, they're going for it.
They're not sorry.
No.
But it's been, you know, they've been mostly in, you know, areas with a lot of Sunni. And because of that, there really hasn't been, like, as much resistance to their, you know, to them encroaching on this territory as you would think there would be from, like, an ideologically bonkers town group.
Yeah.
Also, the Iraqi military that we trained so professionally has just been deserting.
They're
up
over
a storm.
It.
They've been in situations where they've been, like, destroying their own equipment to stop, you know, these insurgent groups from getting to them, and then deserting. Everyone's up to deserting. Wouldn't you? It looks hopeless.
Right. They have a really high desertion rate.
Huge.
There. Yeah.
But not all Sunnis in Iraq are, you know, allied with these insurgents, obviously. That would be a massive overstatement. But there are reasons that the Sunnis are upset, some of which are legitimate. One of which is not legitimate, which is that, for some reason, under Saddam, there was, like, this rumor that Sunnis were actually in the majority. Like, that was a rumor he was, like, proffering around town. And so a lot of people think that they're in, like, the demographic majority. A lot of Sunnis think that in Iraq, which is a weird thing.
That is.
So because of that, they sort of, there is sort of this element that they're, like, the rightful owners of Iraq. And it's not true, because they only make up, like, a fifth of the population or something. So that's a little bonkers town. But the sort of new government in the post-Iraq War Iraq did, like, go real extreme in getting rid of the Ba'ath Party members, you know, that were still sort of, like, around and causing shenanigans. So this sort of extreme de-Ba'athification of the party has left a lot of Sunnis feeling like they're being targeted.
Right.
And that maybe also has started in a legitimate place because they are being targeted in terms of arrest and torture.
Right.
They make up, they have a much higher incarceration rate than Shia. And a lot of them are, there's no transparency, there's no due process. And a lot of, you know, like relatives are being forced to pay ransoms on people that were not detained for any reason and stuff like that is going on. So that would piss me off too. And then also, the current government has shown some favor for some Shia militias that aren't afraid to persecute Sunnis. So the president there now is not really a friend to the Sunnis, and he's been rather active in...
He's up for re-election, too, isn't
he? He's up for re-election. Yeah. He's been allied with a couple of Shia militias, including one that seems to run the transportation ministry, and began as... like a military wing of an Iran-backed Shia group.
Right, well, and speaking of Iran, and I mean, that's the other thing that is sort of like throwing a wrench into this whole situation is that they're very much involved because they're sort of, they've got, you know, ties to ISIS and some of the ISIS people sort of like are, you know, have, like, Tehran is involved, basically. Yeah. Like, they're directly involved.
Tehran is involved. The mainstream Sunnis are relatively weak because they're kind of divided along various lines. Like, some are allied with the government still, some aren't, but don't feel like this is the right way to go. So no one, there's really no one offering resistance on the Sunni side. And it's sort of left everyone in a stalemate. Because ISIS can't realistically, like, take the entire nation, obviously. Right. But they do want to create sort of this weird fundamentalist megastate out of territories they've pieced together from Syria and Iraq that are, you know, that are primarily Sunni territories. And there's some issues with that because the territory that they want isn't particularly wealthy and kind of relies economically on Baghdad. So they kind of need Baghdad to, like, make it work. But they can't really have Baghdad unless they, like, really go for it.
Right. Which
they're trying to. Yeah. But it is sort of, it is potentially possible that they will wind up with, like, some independent region within Iraq. Like, that's not out of the question.
Yeah.
And Tehran has a couple of, like, sort of random interests in the region because there's, like, some shrines that they want to protect and some other things. So they're sort of, like, padding carefully into this, but they have been providing military support to this group.
Yeah.
Because they are obviously allied with them to some extent. So it's been a little bit odd from, you know, from the U.S. perspective, it's been a little bit difficult to tell sort of like what Tehran's intentions are.
Right.
Because they've been providing military support and economic support, but they've also sort of been kind of trying to be careful about like how destructive they're being.
Yeah.
But also it's just causing a problem for the U.S. because politicians, obviously warmongers want to immediately go in and bomb everyone to smithereens.
Right.
And it's likely to cause a very bad humanitarian crisis if we don't go in. Or if we do go in. Really, there's going to be a humanitarian crisis.
Well, and regardless. That's what everybody... I think people on both sides obviously have their, you know, their own agenda as to how they want to deal with this. But I think that everyone has sort of generally agreed that there's not a great way to do it.
No.
I mean, I don't think that anybody thinks that they have the winning answer.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody sort of has their own ideas. But, it's a real lose-lose.
It's a real boondoggle for Obama because Iraq has asked for airstrikes, for U.S. airstrikes to, like, come in. And obviously, the U.S. historically has loved a good airstrike in Iraq. We've been airstriking since, like, the 80s.
Right.
But that's, you know, Obama finally got us out of this war. And the American public is not super enthralled with the concept of going into another open-ended struggle with a region that we don't fully understand.
Right.
Because shit is complicated over there.
Yeah.
And so there's no way to know whether we're making the problem worse or better by providing support, military support.
Right.
It's our concerns, I think, at the moment are mostly being driven by the fact that both Saudi Arabia and Israel are, like, real pissed about this turn of events. So that is, and those are our two big allies in the region, unfortunately. But but so that's those the shifting dynamics of power in Iraq and the sort of return to Sunni you know, power are not sitting well with Saudi Arabia and with Israel. That's sort of where our interest seems to come in.
Right.
But also, you know, there's the potential that a terrifying new state will be created that is like a hardcore fundamentalist state. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
Shit's a mess.
It's a big mess, you know, and there's been, it's brought up this sort of debate as to sort of like, why did we go in there in the first place? A lot of people have been, you know, you get the sort of like John McCain's of the world who are like, you know, had we left 10,000 troops in there, this would not be happening. But also, like, I think it's important to remember and that, yes, Obama did get us out of this war, and, you know, we can sort of, like, debate whether if we had troops still there, whether this would be happening or not. But the other thing that I think people forget a lot of times is the Iraqi government specifically asked us to leave.
Yeah.
Yes, Obama decided that it was okay for us to leave, but they did not want us there. No. They wanted us to train their army, which apparently is not doing much of anything. But I mean, like, you know, they are trying to govern themselves, and they're not trying to have 15,000 American troops roaming around all over the place. They wanted us to leave. And I think the other thing that can be debated, and I think a lot of people, and I sort of touched on it earlier, is that there are many a people who think that this mess would not be going on currently had we not gone in the first place.
Well, that was one of the things when we went in there in the first place that a lot of people discussed as a reason why this war was kind of a shitty plan.
Right. It's going to turn the country into a fucking disaster zone.
Yeah, this was the sort of one thing that you could say for Saddam Hussein. He was horribly brutal. All of those things are true.
Right.
He was essentially a Stalinist. But he was holding together this, like, very, very difficult, you know, sort of mass of people who were all at each other's throats.
Right.
Sometimes with violence and sometimes with completely inappropriate, you know, methods.
Sure.
But it was something. He seemed to be the only person who had been leading Iraq in the kind of modern era who had been able to really do that and keep a lid on things.
Right.
And so a lot of people suggested that though he was not an ideal leader, that the one thing that you could say for him
was he was stabilizing the region.
And so this, you know, us going in the first place was a totally destabilizing move. Which obviously it was, because they've been in a civil war since we got there. But this is a good example of why strong leadership was sort of working to an extent in that region, and why our sort of like grand plans about this coalition government that was going to come together were sort of naive.
Right.
You know, it's not a two-party state over there. It's like a zillion party state.
Right.
It's not just like, oh, well, the Democrats are the Republicans.
Crazy party state.
It's like a one zillion crazy pants party state.
Right.
Where everyone is allied based on totally bizarre, you know, theological issues that have nothing to do with real life.
Mm-hmm. And they'll kill you for it.
And they'll kill you for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's so, you know, that's why, like, you know, the Kurds are sort of historically famous because there was this genocide, you know, that they basically, you know, there was this huge attack on them. They basically tried to commit genocide. The Kurds are also some of the most, like, militaristic, crazy pants people out there in the world. So, like, everyone there is, like, armed to the teeth.
Yep.
They're willing to kill you for nothing.
Yep.
And they're all trying to take a piece of territory. It's like a fake country. It's like it's an arbitrary country that we were like, well, this will be a border. Iraq is not, like, a natural country. In the way that, like, France is. In France, they all speak French, and that's how they all became, you know, there's sort of a cultural unity in France that doesn't exist in a lot of the Middle East because they were countries that were sort of put together piecemeal by colonial powers.
Yeah.
So, like, Iraq is, it's tough over there. It's hard to understand what's going on.
And it is.
I would argue that we don't,
despite
the fact that we sort of set off a chain of events that is really causing this issue.
Yeah.
It destabilized the region enough that a group like this could come in and just sort of, like, crazy pants their way through town.
Yeah. It's interesting because George W. Bush is very silent on this right now. Because Tony Blair has been sort of finding any camera that
mouthing
he can
up a storm.
Get in front of, talking about how, you know, the 2003 war didn't destabilize, you know, I mean, he sort of is trying to defend himself, basically, but, like, George W. Bush just sort of, like, over it, which is fine, because I don't need him talking about anything, because it's going to be wrong.
He didn't have ideas then. He certainly doesn't have them now.
No, they should ask Dick Cheney.
Yeah, exactly. That's who is having thoughts.
Yeah.
Not good thoughts. Not thoughts that that a non-robot would have, but thoughts nonetheless.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, because there are so many implications, as you know, as to our relationship with Iran in the aftermath of all of this, a lot of people have been asking sort of like whether we talk to Iran.
Right. And
so you know who's in favor of doing that?
Yeah. Lindsey Graham.
Oddly.
Curious here. He was being interviewed yesterday on CNN and he said we should have discussions with Iran to make sure they don't use this as an opportunity to seize control of parts of Iraq. They're in this. They're already on the ground. We need to put a red line with Iran. And so he was being interviewed by Gloria Borger and Dana Bash on CNN. And so they pressed him and they were like, well, how would you do this?
You
and he said, you just sit down with them and talk. And like Gloria Borger and Dana Bash were so taken aback. They literally, like, made him repeat himself, and they said, quote, "I'm sorry, it's sort of hard for me to believe that I'm hearing a Republican say, sit down and talk with Iran." And it's true. But, I mean,
Kerry was hitting the airwaves all day today, right, talking about how that's something that he would like to do as well.
We might be having, like, the first unilateral talks with Iran that we've had since...
Yeah. Which, forever. I mean, to be fair, like, their government has been in transition. So it's not... You know,
we have hinted at
wanting to do this in the past
for a while
because
about
they
their
have
nuclear
seemed
program.
Right. They have seemed slightly more open than they used to be. But this would be an interesting point of contention for our first unilateral talks.
Yeah,
because it's sort of like this proxy war that we're all getting involved in.
Exactly.
That has nothing to do with us.
Right.
I mean, it has to do with us because we destabilized the entire region. But it's not like these are political alliances that have anything to do with U.S. policy.
Right. Exactly.
It's just like a bunch of people fighting each other about various fundamentalist nonsense.
The other thing that's interesting about this, and this is sort of like a real throwback here, but one of the things that people have been talking about over the last week, really, is that one of the potential solutions to this problem, if you can call it a solution, is sort of like a three-state Iraq, basically.
Right.
Or, you know, three separate countries, even, potentially.
Which is, I mean, essentially what we were just talking about, because the country is cobbled together between three very distinct ethnic groups that don't like each other.
Well, someone had this idea 10 years ago, and he got laughed out of the joint, and it's our Vice President Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Like, he was campaigning on this. I remember this.
Yeah.
Because he was he was sort of fashioning himself as the foreign policy expert in the 2008 race, and all through 2007, this is what he was advocating for, because that was the big sort of issue of the day, if you remember back in 2008, was, the Iraq war, how do we get out, what's going on, you know, everybody was ragging on Clinton for voting for it, and that was sort of, like, ended up how we ended up with President Obama, really. And this is what Joe Biden's solution was a three-state Iraq. So much it even got a vote in the Senate. It didn't pass. But, I mean, like, he was really – this was his big go-to sort of, like, foreign policy talking point. And everybody thought he was just crazy old Uncle Joe.
And what he was talking about is something that should be familiar to most Americans, because he was talking about a federalist system, essentially, there.
Right.
He was talking about autonomous – I can't say the word – autonomous regions, three autonomous regions in Iraq that would essentially function like states.
Yeah.
So that's something – would you want to have to share all your government officials with Mississippi? Like, no, obviously not. They're insane over there.
Yeah.
So, like, this is how we solve the problem in the U.S., because we have an enormous nation that's very diverse and filled with a lot of regional concerns, is we have a federal system. So that's essentially what he was advocating there. Like, I've never understood why everyone thought that was so crazy.
I know.
Like, it seems like an obvious plan that seems like a genius move.
Well, because everybody at that time was still obsessed with, I mean, just winning the war.
Right.
I think. You know what
as
I mean?
As if there was something to win there. As if we could... that was what was also curious about that war, was there was not anything for us to win in it.
I know.
So, like, too bad.
Well, and that is sort of what I think what adds, you know, this extra layer of tragedy to this whole situation in Iraq, is that it really sort of, like, gives you that it makes you think to yourself sort of, like, well, what the fuck was all that for?
No, exactly.
You know what I mean? Because it's sort of like, we went to war in 2003. We lost how many thousands of American lives?
We spent trillions of dollars
that we could have been spending domestically.
Bajillion is not a real number, but trillions is.
Trillion is, and it's right.
Yeah.
Trillions is correct. And, you know, it got us what? It got us back to
launch airstrikes again. For a nation that still doesn't have any sort of leadership. Because everyone is at each other's throats.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's just, ugh.
Yeah, it's a mess.
It's a mess.
The Iraq War, failure.
Yeah. But anyway, Joe Biden might have a campaign talking point. He can run his 2007 campaign over again.
Yeah, round two. He's going to be running against the same people, probably, because
that's true.
That seems to be all that goes on.
Can you imagine?
It's him and Hillary in the road again.
Can you imagine if Iraq is the big issue of the day for Hillary?
Oh my God.
Again?
My God.
She just literally.
That, by the way, is my dream.
It's my dream, but
it's terrible.
It's almost so terrible that, like, that would be a thing that I would maybe feel bad for her for.
It's.
Just because, like,
I realize
she voted for the thing, and she should be ashamed of that, and she should not be allowed to be president for that. But, I mean, like, that's some fucking luck right there.
That's so true.
Right?
After all of her time as Secretary of State, and, like, none of this was going on, and everything was hunky-dory.
And defend her Iraq war vote again 8 years after she lost the nomination because of it once.
Yeah.
Poor,
too bad. And also,
girl.
What you get for know, voting for true. A dumb war that's... that had no purpose.
Yeah, exactly.
But you should always expect.
Yep.
It'll always come back. The greatest thing that could have happened in American politics.
Yeah.
Ever. The greatest upset in American history, as far as
basically,
as far as
I mean,
really anyone's concerned.
People are saying that.
Yeah. Happened this week.
Yeah.
Eric Cantor lost his primary.
Lost his primary.
And did not see it coming at all.
No. Like, his pollster had him like winning by like 30-some points or something like that.
His pollster
saw
him winning with 62% of the vote.
Yeah.
His pollster, by the way, has a history of being an idiot. So that's a problem.
this is like a Republican pollster problem.
Yeah.
You know why?
John McLaughlin.
Like
they don't like math. They don't believe in science. There's no hard facts exist in their universe.
He probably asked, 12 people.
Right. Well, and he has historically had this problem.
Yeah.
His pollster is a guy that is having wrong poll numbers a lot. But one of the issues that he didn't foresee is that something like 20,000 more people turned out than they expected.
Yeah.
All of them not voting for Eric Cantor.
Right. Well, and the one thing that the pollster did say, and I don't know if there is a way, because it's an open primary, I don't know if these stats ever come out or not. But
about
like,
who were Republicans and who were Democrats
that
voted.
There was a late push for Democrats to vote for, what's his name, Dave Bratt, I think, is the guy who ended up beating Cantor.
This is always something that people in open primary states claim is happening, though, and I don't think it's that true, because...
The only reason that I would think that it could potentially be true here is that there was not a contested Democratic primary.
Right.
Because normally, why would I go and vote for the person running against Eric Cantor when I am voting in my own Democratic primary that I would prefer to be picking a candidate in?
Yeah.
But that wasn't an option
That's
so
true.
So you really could vote in that primary just for fun if you wanted to.
But a lot of it is being blamed on some things that Eric Cantor could have controlled.
Yes.
One being that he was so busy trying to secede Boehner. To succeed Boehner.
Yeah.
I said secede like he was he was trying to get rid of it.
Eliminate him from America.
From America. He was trying to succeed Boehner. I'm having talking issues today. I don't know why. It's late. Whatever.
Yeah.
But because of that, he was spending a lot of time in Washington trying to court influential Republicans in D.C. and was not really ever in his district.
He was sort of known, even, even with people sort of, who were allies in the district, as someone who didn't come home very often. He always sort of, he never wanted to have town halls. He didn't really sort of, he was a very sort of, Washington guy, basically.
Yeah. Well, and more than that, he had this district that was sort of, filled with a lot of evangelical-y kind of Tea Partiers. And he never was really able, because he had had close races before for his seat.
Yeah.
He was never really able to court their votes the way that his contenders were, because he was Jewish.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know that anti-Semitism played a part in the vote, but he just didn't connect a lot of the crazier voters in his district because of it.
Well, and he was asked about that, and he didn't sort of want to blame it on that. I mean, he's been sort of...
He's
been sort of gracious in his defeat, shockingly.
It's true. I'm sure that it was not an active, bigotry issue. I think it was more that his opponent was somebody that could connect with those voters and did.
Yes.
And that had happened to him in his very first election to that seat. He won by a very slim margin in his first primary race for that seat.
Yeah.
And it was for the same reason. It was he couldn't really connect with evangelical voters. He's kind of this Wall Street guy, but he's not in a district with he's in a district with Richmond, but he's not in a district with giant moneyed urban areas or anything.
I was reading an article actually, because this district has been sort of, gerrymandered to within an inch of its life. But it is not so crazy Republican that if this guy is too nutty, he can't lose, that this can't be a Democratic picker.
No.
Because there have been sort of within the last couple election cycles, and even how Obama did in this district, it's not out of reach if this Dave Bratt character is a giant fuck up, which he's going to be, and we'll get to that in a second, or I will anyway. But I mean, it's sort of the problem when you run as sort of a candidate who, is just sort of a broad appeal candidate, in the sense that broadly appealing to your base, to the Tea Party, which is what he was. I mean, if you can believe it, he was running to Eric Cantor's right, which I didn't know was a place that existed.
No, it's a place in Virginia.
It's a place in Virginia, apparently. But the problem is that, he sort of was this insurgent candidate. He didn't have any money. I mean, he was ultimately sort of he was a fake candidate.
Yeah.
I mean, on some level. But the problem is when you run campaigns like that, you end up, once you get the nomination, you sort of realize that you don't really know what you think about anything.
Yeah.
I mean, he was sort of like...
No, exactly.
He was sort of like peddling these sort of just like broad things that like Tea Party candidates or, yeah. you know, Tea Party voters love. But sort of like immediately after he got the nomination, he was sort of like doing the rounds and was getting asked about policy
and positions. Was saying different things to everyone.
Right.
Because
he teaches economics.
Yeah.
And he was asked about what he thought about the minimum wage and literally said, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. Minimum wage is going to be like one of the issues yeah. in this election.
In this
cycle. And he teaches economics, which
at
you
Randolph
should just,
Macon
you
College.
Should just know as an economics teacher the answer to what you think yeah. about minimum wage, regardless of whether you're running for Congress or not. But you yeah. end up with people who don't know what they think because all they've been doing is spouting, you
nonsense.
Know, nonsense about, you know, crazy right-wing wackoness.
Well, and Cantor lost a lot of votes based on this one attack that he made on, or not one, he was running a lot of attack ads, but one specific line of attack that he kept making where he kept calling him a liberal college professor. And that didn't connect with voters because the guy was crazy.
Yeah.
And so it sort of just ended up discrediting Cantor,
right.
which is funny. But the other thing that I think is really interesting about this race, this district was gerrymandered, just like all districts are.
Mm-hmm.
It was gerrymandered to be a safer district for Cantor. So it became they gerrymandered it into a slightly more conservative district than it had been.
Yeah.
And many people think that that could be what lost him the vote.
Oh, interesting.
Because this guy was able to run to his right. You know, Republican candidates have to be careful if they're part of the sort of, like, party leadership, like, you know, sort of not... I won't say he's part of the moderate wing, but he has to sort of have broad appeal to some extent to be part of the party leadership the way he is.
Right.
And when you're a candidate like that, whose real connections are to Wall Street and money and not really to crazy pants issues...
Right.
When you redistrict yourself into a district that... has no thinking thoughts going on in it, you
yeah.
have to worry about,
yeah.
you know, you have to worry about something like this happening. And a lot of people think that, you know, and this is sort of the flip side of the argument of whether whether Democrats entered this race and voted against him. They also wonder whether he maybe made the district too safe for Republicans.
Yeah.
So safe that a crazy person could get elected there.
Yeah, exactly.
Which,
well, that's when you make a district like very heavily Republican.
That's
then
what you get, guys.
The base voters of that new district are nuts.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and it's, you know, it's not even, it's that they redistricted him into a district where the conservative voters are more conservative.
Right.
So it's
exactly.
not that they don't have Democrats in that district, and it's not that as a whole, Cantor wasn't sort of like a person who could represent that district.
Right.
Crazy as they are.
Right.
But it's that you don't want your primary voters, you don't want your base in the district to be like insane.
But Eric Cantor really is sort of like the furthest to the right of the Republican leadership.
Of the Republican leadership, he
because
is.
Because he's further
not
to the right
of
than,
the Republican caucus.
No, not at
you
all.
Know?
But
I mean,
like, if your congressman is Eric Cantor and you're a crazy person, then...
You're feeling good about
when he's
crazy
second,
people winning.
When he's second in command and he's sort of like of John Boehner and himself and... Kevin McCarthy, who's the whip, who is probably, we'll get to in a second,
right.
going to be the new majority leader.
Succeed him, not succeed him.
Right. You know, he's by leaps and bounds the furthest to the right of those three people. I mean,
yeah.
So at least to me, even if I was, but, you know, these people aren't having very intelligent thoughts, no. the Tea Party people. If I was a Tea Party person, I would say, well, Eric Cantor is like second in line and he's my congressperson. And while he's not as batshit crazy as I maybe personally am, like, I'm doing okay. With
right.
him as a crazy person.
We seem like
who's
a pretty
Congress.
Important district these days. But they also, they suffered from, they were doing a little Romneying in that they lost their guy on the ground because this was not like something they couldn't have seen coming if they had been looking for it.
Right.
They treated this guy, Dave Bratt, like sort of like a nuisance, like they
right.
weren't really that into,
right.
you know, dealing with him. But they had a district convention at which Eric Cantor got booed. They lost the district chairman, who was sort of like their guy on the ground,
right.
Who got voted out. And because of that, they lost their control of like the machine
right.
that gets Cantor elected. So this was not without any sort of like precedent.
Right.
This was sort of the way things were turning in the district. And they were just sort of blind to it because they
yeah.
were spending so much time campaigning to, you know, to take over Congress that they,
yeah.
they couldn't take over their own district seat.
Yep.
So in any case, it was a huge
right. and it can't really
upset.
Be it can't really be overstated because like
yeah.
you know, I mean, he's been in Congress for 14 years now and he sort of, it was a quick rise. People, like you said,
right.
assumed that he was going to take over for Boehner as, you know,
he was in line
as speaker, and I mean, it was just a
and he resigned from his majority leader position the next day.
He did, yes.
So
I think
he's out.
Right, he's out, and so...
He's irrelevant now. We don't care about him anymore.
Nope.
Yeah.
Raspberry to you.
That's right.
Eric Cantor. But so now we have to figure out who's going to be the new majority leader, and... It's probably going to be Kevin McCarthy. That's who everybody... He's the majority whip currently. He's fairly well-liked. He's got a lot of support from people. But Raul Labrador...
Late challenger.
...is coming in late into the game, and he sort of might be the wingnut favorite to take over.
Well, that's basically
just
what's
enough
happened.
To cause trouble.
You know, both in the whip race and in the majority leader race, they have, like, one guy who's kind of like the guy that they think will be the guy, and then they have one crazy pants conservative who's, like, come in late.
Right.
Because for a while we thought Pete Sessions was going to run, and then he kind of...
He decided not to. He probably saw the Kevin McCarthy
writing on the
wall. Yeah.
Raul Labrador was sort of a late entrant into the race. And he's been... He's sort of odd because he is the conservative in that race, for sure. And really only crazies will support him.
Yeah.
But he's, like, really big on immigration. He's from Puerto Rico. He has a lot of, you know, and he had been part of the gang of however many people it was who had been working on immigration until he, like, left in a huff over one specific thing having to do with, like, healthcare for, you know, undocumented people or something.
Didn't want him to have it.
But because of that, a lot of people think he might not be conservative enough to really appeal to the real wing nuts. And, like, obviously McCarthy is going to appeal to the, like, regular nuts.
Right.
So he might not really have a constituency in that race.
Yeah. I mean, Kevin McCarthy is actually sort of, like, not... super crazy. I mean, he's like medium crazy.
He's from California.
He's from California.
Raul Labrador is drawing shit from Steve King, so you know shit's real.
Yeah. Wonder why he hasn't thrown his hat into the ring.
Why not?
Yet, Oh, you know what? They did finally, you know how Bill Maher is doing Flip a District?
Yeah.
Steve King has finally been added into the Flip a District mix.
Thank God.
So we'll see how that goes, but anyway.
Terribly.
So, and then
I took a picture of his district for you while I was.
Oh, that's right. I know. Lila flew over Iowa.
Mm-hmm. I was in his district.
Square block.
I'm always
shocked
when I fly over the Midwest, like how organized and square and perfectly measured everything is.
Mm-hmm.
That just like really blows my mind. It's like having a grid pattern, but for the country instead of the city.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, I want to go to my friend's house, and you can take any number of roads to get there because they all just like lead you in like perpendicular patterns that you can. It's crazy. It blows my mind.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't know if I ever want to see that on the ground. Sounds like it might be really depressing. In any case, for the whip race, they also have a bunch of conservatives running in that race. But they're all sort of like people I don't know anything about, so I can't really share any insights into that race.
Yeah, who cares?
No. We'll know about them as soon as they become the whip, because then we'll have to know who they are.
Yeah, exactly.
But in any case... More primary news.
Yeah, this is a really interesting one because, and I haven't heard anybody else talk about this, but it's Charlie Rangel, who is 84 and is, as
an
you
institution.
Said, an institution. You know, he's been in Congress for 1,000 years, is and rarely even gets a primary challenge,
mm-hmm.
is in a sort of dogfight to win his primary now. He pulled out of the last debate after sort of like really getting hammered in the first debate. And what I love about this story is... the things that he's getting hammered for. Because it's his ties to Wall Street, his vote to repeal
Glass-Steagall,
and his vote to on some of the issues with some of the provisions in the Dodd-Frank bill.
Yeah.
So this guy who's running against him, who I can't even say his name, it's Adriano...
I think it's Espelot.
Espelot,
but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I've heard of him. He's been in and around the New York City political scene for a little while.
Right. Is really sort of like hitting him on these issues, which I think is just so fascinating. I think it's sort of like it's a microcosm of what I think could be, and you and I have talked a lot about what, you know, similarly to the New York City's mayor's race and some of the other races.
Could be a populist uprising.
Some of the other races. You know, within Democratic primaries or, you know, in Democratic strongholds where you're seeing this play out almost similarly to how it's playing out on the right in a way, I think to a less sort of like Civil
Crazy
War style
degree
because I think that they are really sort of like...
They are grappling with what to do.
They're grappling with what to do and I don't
Democrats
think
Democrats know what to do with these people.
I don't think we necessarily are grappling quite as hard in the sense that like the party is split.
No.
But like you are seeing a lot of... you know, primaries and elections that are sort of being fought along these lines of, you know, corporate ties to Wall Street and sort of, you know, big banks and bailouts and, you know.
Well, and this is genius timing because Charlie Rangel was for a long time someone you didn't want to challenge because he was a member of the New York caucus who was the head of the Ways and Means Committee.
Yeah.
He didn't want to lose the New York control
right.
of the Ways and Means Committee. That didn't make sense to anyone as right. an idea. But he lost that when all of those corruption charges went
right.
down.
Well, and I think that's so the other thing that you probably...
He doesn't have the kind of right. sway that he once did right. that makes it worth continuing to elect a guy who we've known for years right. had connections to Wall Street yeah. and was sort of under the table voting in slightly corrupt ways on a lot of financial right. regulation.
And I think that you can't sort of totally discount all of his ethics issues because I think that
yeah.
they... I think... alone, they wouldn't be sort of enough to maybe make this primary challenge
right.
close.
Right, well, they weren't in the last one.
Right, in the last one. But they are enough to make sort of a good argument against him stick.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like, which is
exactly.
sort of what's happening here. I think if he didn't have these ethics issues, this Adriano Espaillat could be talking about his vote against Glass-Steagall all he wanted to, and
no one
would have
ever heard him say that.
It. Right, exactly. But you get yeah. to care now because Charlie Rangel is Charlie Rangel.
Well, and I wonder if their district was slightly redistricted as well. I know a lot of the New York City districts were because my parents' congressperson changed from one institution to another. But this is going to be a really interesting precedent if it happens because
right.
it's going to have to change the way that Democrats address these issues. A lot of them have been voting on Wall Street regulation like a bunch of corrupt thieves and then not facing any kind of repercussions at home.
No, especially in the House too because like, you know,
right,
you can sort of assume that you're going to get away with it, which I think is what's
so
fascinating about this because like if we are now going to allow people to not be getting away with this, then people are really going to have to sort of like think about how they run campaigns, how they actually vote when they're in the House, which is sort of nice because they should be having to think about those things.
I think, you know, I hear a lot of people still are questioning what Occupy accomplished. This, I think, is one thing
they accomplished. Because
did you know what Glass-Steagall was specifically before Occupy? Had you been paying attention to Dodd-Frank? No, of course not. You, as humans, we had other things to do because those were boring bills that you didn't want to know about.
Yep. You know what those things are.
Now you know what those are.
You know about, you know, we talked last week about student loans. I mean, that was a big thing they were pushing. We know what people are talking about raising the minimum wage. That's going to be an election issue
you
in the
midterms. You care about financial regulation now, whereas before you didn't want to know about it because it's such a boring topic.
Right.
So that is one thing that I think, and especially in New York where Occupy was sort of a big deal and started, that is something that we can say has changed because of Occupy.
I totally agree. Yep.
I think of things all the time that have changed because of Occupy, by the way. People are still getting on TV talking about how that fizzled and didn't accomplish anything. And then they'll go on about the 1%.
Right.
And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me.
I know.
You have got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
Bunch of fools.
Yeah.
Up on television.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Speaking of ties to Wall Street.
It's time for Hillary.
Hillary. All right. So Hillary Clinton's book is out. Hard Choices.
So unfortunately, she's been making the rounds. Unfortunately for her.
Exactly.
It's been great for us.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like Gaffe City this week.
She's just up to saying things. She's Romneying.
She totally
She was
is.
Romneying all fucking week.
Yeah, she really was. So, this first one specifically. Because you know what was really tragic about what happened when the Clintons got out of the White House? They didn't have enough money for all of their houses.
Oh, it's so sad.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so sad.
They really struggled.
Yeah, they struggled. She was quoted as saying, we came out of the White House. White House? White House?
The White House.
I don't know what that is. The White House, not only dead broke, but in debt. We had no money when we got there, and we struggled to piece together the resources for mortgages, for houses, for Chelsea's education. You know, it was not easy. So, yeah, plural houses.
And then immediately they became millionaires again.
Right, I know.
Somehow they made it all work.
Who knew?
Speaking fees, my friends.
Uh-huh. She became a senator.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton had speaking fees. She
he
was
started a foundation that probably pays him to do foundational type work.
Yep. So you may imagine she had to quickly backtrack on that. Like, immediately, like the next day.
Yeah.
Sort of had to apologize. She came out and she was like, she literally said, "Let me just clarify. I fully appreciate how hard life is for so many Americans today. Yada, yada, yada." But like
these are the moments that you know that she can't get through a whole fucking presidential campaign without falling into a million zillion traps. Because this is what happens when you're too much on the inside and you try to run for president.
Well, and
I'm sure that it was challenging for them when they left the White House.
You don't get rich being the president.
You certainly you spend a lot of money because you're campaigning. You know, you're campaigning constantly. You're constantly sort of like on, you know, trying to sort of like make something else happen.
Right.
I get all of it.
Right.
You can't say that.
No, you can't
say
that.
You just can't. Sorry.
Nope.
It's a it's a bad time to say it because people are still alive who are not as rich as you were then.
Right, who are homeless, who are working three jobs at minimum wage to be able to feed their children on food stamps.
You can't appreciate how hard life is for most people.
Right.
And that's good for you. That's been nice. It's probably been a nice life not being able to appreciate that. But you just, this is the kind of thing Mitt Romney was always doing.
Yep.
Is he was forgetting that you can't say mortgages plural and be talking about a real problem.
Right.
Uh-huh. And that ultimately was what made him impossible to like as a person.
Right.
And this is going to do the same thing for her because people are already not going to like her because she's a woman.
Right.
So she's already got that working against her.
Well, and this is what, you know, it's statements like this that sort of like, you know, we just talked about Charlie Rangel. It's statements like this that sort of like, you know, are going to allow her to be Charlie Rangel'd in a, you know, in a Democratic primary. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, she just, she doesn't have a grasp of...
Well, and this is... She's so savvy that this shouldn't be a problem.
No.
She is savvy enough to know.
Maybe she is actually brain damaged.
It's just like, it's infuriating that we can be like so excited and so on board about a candidate who can mess up having the best possible preparation for running for president.
Right.
You know who wasn't getting great prep for running for president? Obama, because he was just some guy that they tapped like a few years before then.
To do and some then, speech.
And then, and then was suddenly like thrust into the limelight and had to become president.
Yeah.
That's a guy who didn't have a lot of preparation.
Yeah.
He was luckily a put together guy who knew when and when not to talk about how rich he was. But this is, doesn't seem to be something that Hillary Clinton has a grasp on, which is too bad.
Yeah.
And maybe, just maybe, she shouldn't be on a book tour.
God. The other thing that happened on this book tour, which I think is, you know, she was on Fresh Air, which I love.
I love
Fresh Everybody Air. Everybody loves Fresh Air.
Of course. Terry Gross.
Terry Gross.
You're not trying to not love Fresh Air. Yeah.
Yeah. But the other thing that's sort of like, first off, I understand like why you want to go on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, basically, like when you're hawking a book. But like also, if you think that you might be running for president at some point, like also don't go on Fresh Air.
She might ask you a question.
She's going to ask questions that you don't want to answer, which is exactly what happened. And she asked one specific that she really didn't want to freaking answer. And I was so happy about this because I have been peddling this with all my freaking gay friends for years. Because you know who loves Hillary Clinton? The gays.
Yeah.
You know why? I don't fucking know.
No, nobody can.
Nobody knows.
Because you know who was not in support of gay marriage in the early days
Hillary
of this
Clinton,
fight? Hillary
for
Clinton.
For ages. And she wants to run on Bill Clinton being the president. You know who signed DOMA and Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
That would be Bill Clinton.
Her husband, when she was co-presidenting, presidenting the country with him. And even when in 2008, and granted, no one was running on a pro-gay marriage platform in 2008, but you know who also wasn't? Her.
Hillary Clinton.
She certainly wasn't.
So it's interesting that she now takes issue with people describing the exact chain of events in which she switched from being against gay marriage
because
to for
Terry Gross basically said, now, asked her pretty much point blank, she said, now, did you change your mind, or did the country sort of like coming around to the issue allow you to just state what you already thought?
Right.
And like she got really, as what people have been calling it, testy. And we'll get to that in a little bit.
Right. We have other thoughts about how this was handled by the press.
Right.
As you might imagine.
And she did not like this at all. She got very testy.
Yeah.
And she said, I have to say, I think you're being very persistent, but you are playing with my words and playing with what is such an important issue. And Terry Gross responded, I'm just trying to clarify so that I understand. And Clinton immediately shot back and she said, no, I don't think you are trying to clarify. I think you're trying to say I used to be opposed and now I'm in favor and I did it for political reasons. That's what happened. And that's just flat wrong.
Or flat right.
Or flat right. So let me just state what I feel like you are implying and repudiate it. I have a strong record. I have a great commitment to this issue and I am proud of what I've done and the progress we're making. And she really sort of like, when she was Secretary of State, I'll give her that she sort of like fought in favor of LGBT issues sort of like around the world. And that is a reason that we can sort of like pretend like we like her if we want. But like when it comes to sort of like her being out in front on these issues, she was just
not. She never has been.
She never, ever, ever, ever has been.
Never.
So, I mean,
like, that chain of events that she describes as an incorrect chain of events is the exact chain of events that occurred.
Well, right. And, like, the story that ended up coming out of this was how angry she got with Terry Gross.
Right.
But, like, I personally was just sort of like, yes! Because, like, this is the question of the
day. How long have you been waiting for someone to just finally ask this fucking question?
Right. And I sort of kind of understand that when you're Secretary of State, you don't go around, like, stating, like, your policy position. So I think, like, on some level, she really did sort of have to wait until she was out of, that job as Secretary of State. And she really only waited a couple weeks after that. But, like, at that point, it was sort of, like, old news for her to do anyway. And I also do sort of take issue with it because I think that she could have said it earlier, like, as Secretary of State, because she was out there talking about LGBT issues. Right. So, like, why couldn't she have just sort of, like, casually been like, oh, yeah, I'm for gay marriage? I mean, like, people were doing it at that point.
Like, also, I feel like why, if, you know, this is a fair question, because this really was the chain of events that occurred with a lot of politicians, where people who obviously personally didn't give a shit were against gay marriage and told the country was for it, and then they were like, oh, no, I'm for it. No, I've always been for it.
Right. Well, so, and a lot of people
this is, I think, a fair... It's a fair question to ask whether her personal views came around or whether the country just changed and she realized she could finally come out with her real views, because that is the question that is on everyone's mind.
Right. Well, and I think had she... the other issue here is I think that not just that she got angry with Terry Gross, but how she sort of handled the question just in general, because, like, I think had she responded and said, yes, I changed along with the country. I had,
Like, this question could have been a win for her.
It could have been, like, there's no reason why that couldn't be just, like, a thing that she could have said, and it would have been fine. I mean, everybody has been saying that they've evolved on the issue. That's what Obama's been saying, and now he's all of a sudden a champion on gay rights.
Exactly.
And nobody knocks him for, like, waiting until
for having once
time
not
for,
been
like,
evolved.
Right. You know? I mean,
it's if you have publicly, it doesn't do, I mean, first of all, it makes it sound like she was being disingenuous the entire time.
Right.
Second of all, if you
I think she was.
Which she was. If you have, well, she probably didn't care before. She didn't.
She didn't have
shit.
To.
Why would she care? Like, it just sort of like, if you have publicly stated that you are against gay marriage, and she had said, she went through a phase where she was for civil unions, but she had to come out against gay marriage. Not like, oh, I don't have an opinion, or oh, right. I'm just not going to talk about it. She had been against gay marriage.
Yeah.
If you were once publicly against gay marriage, and then you decided that you were publicly for gay marriage, it's fair to
ask
claim
what
later.
Happened.
First of all, it's fair for us to ask what happened, and it's fair for you to say later that you used to be against it and now you're for it.
Yeah.
Like, why would that be a controversial move for her to make? She's already, that's on the record.
Yeah.
Now what's on
we
the
know
record?
That's what happened.
Right, exactly. Now what's on the record is that she gets really defensive and weird when you ask her questions
and
about
it,
this.
And it makes it just look like both times
she
when
was
she was against it and then for it, she was lying and it was for political reasons.
Yes. Yeah, it just it makes her sound
the
like such a schemer.
Yeah.
But the press obviously handled this as if a woman shouldn't get testy.
Right.
Which is another annoying thing. Brent and I are sick of having to defend Hillary Clinton against sexist charges.
Right.
There are a lot of reasons to dislike Hillary Clinton. One of them is the content of that conversation.
Right. One of them is not because she's a woman.
No. One of them is not because she's a woman. One is not because sometimes she gets mad.
Right.
And that...
But the fact that the story was that she, you know, struck a tone with Terry Gross is really infuriating.
Yeah.
Because that, first off, is not the story here, as
right.
we just discussed. The story is the actual content of the discussion. But, you know, if male politicians sort of raise their voice with Terry Gross in such a way... I mean, this is the thing
that
Chris Christie,
news.
Who is sort of, you know, potentially running for president in 2016, is constantly screaming at the press.
Yeah.
Like, in ways that if she even thought of doing...
And
his constituents. If she even thought about doing some of the things that he is up to, she would literally... We would not be able to even be talking about her as a potential presidential candidate. And that's not fair to her.
No. No.
Or women.
It's only fair to her that we discuss the many policy reasons that she's not qualified to be president.
Yes.
I was talking about this with someone the other day, because I'm often surprised by how many women will say, oh, I don't think we're ready for a female president. And it's based entirely on Hillary Clinton, and they can't put a finger on why they find her kind of irritating. And then I always say, what if it was Elizabeth Warren? And they're always like, oh. Because Elizabeth Warren just somehow sounds so reasonable that you can't argue that we're not ready for someone like her to be president.
Well,
she just sounds so insanely reasonable that there's no reason that her being a woman should have anything to do with anything, and it doesn't even make sense in people's brains that it would. There's something different about the way that Hillary Clinton gets treated in the press, but part of it is because she doesn't seem to know how to not run her mouth at the wrong times.
Right.
It's sort of like, it's an irritating dynamic for her to be stuck in. There are so many reasons that we could be discussing her not being qualified or not being the right
person,
candidate.
Right.
And we never can discuss those reasons because we're always talking about her.
Right. Breaking the glass ceiling.
Breaking the glass ceiling or getting testy.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
That's why gays don't know that they shouldn't support her. Because no one's talked about anything with any actual content.
Right, exactly. Because they like that she's getting testy.
Exactly.
They hear that Hillary Clinton got testy and they're like, yeah, go girl.
They don't realize that she's getting testy defending the fact that she used to be against
gay marriage.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Like, everyone stop.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Anyway, so here's... next story is, we're not going to get too deep into this. We talked a lot about the VA bill that the bipartisan bill that was put forward by Bernie Sanders and John McCain last week. We sort of told you all the things that was in it. It was brought to a vote this week, and it was passed overwhelmingly in the Senate, 93-3. Yeah. So it goes to the House now. Where it will die, potentially. Yeah. Because we don't know where it's getting paid for. But when Bernie Sanders was talking about this on the floor of the Senate, I thought he brought up a good point, because this is getting paid for with, as we talked about last week, some emergency funds.
Right.
And which is why these three Republicans voted against it, because they were like, oh, we're not paying for it or whatever. We paid for the Iraq war with emergency funds. So if you're going to send these soldiers to the war, to a war that you're not going to pay for, then you can
certainly treat them with emergency funds.
Right, exactly. So it's sort of like, all right, fuck off, guys.
Yeah.
But anyway, the veterans of foreign wars, the VFW, are really, and some of the other veterans groups, are really on the case of these three Republicans who voted against it, who are Bob Corker from Tennessee, Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, and Jeff Sessions from Alabama. And like, they were like out issuing statements, and they said the lawmakers put dollars and cents above the interests of the nation's veterans. And like, this is, as a Republican, like, not necessarily like what you want to be like having to defend against.
I have been shocked by how well the GOP has navigated being so patently anti-veteran.
It's amazing.
I just, like, because that the military was like their thing for a long time, for most of time.
Well, blowing things up was
is their
thing.
Yeah. But I mean, this is the kind of, you know, they were getting support from like the extended military complex and family.
Yes.
And now they're being so openly, like, they're so openly disregarding veterans and their families that it just like boggles the mind how they're even existing in their own heads.
I know.
And I don't understand why a dynamic hasn't emerged where the Democrats really get to own the military issue finally.
I don't either.
Because,
I mean, for a while,
we were sort of on the cusp of owning it for a while.
In the last election, I think we owned foreign policy pretty well.
Yeah.
And I think even in 2008, probably, even though we were running against McCain, but we were running on getting out of the Iraq war,
which
was what people wanted at the time.
Yeah.
But you're right. We have never really been able to sort of, like, own this sort of, like,
the
you know,
military
we take care of
the military-industrial complex,
right, exactly.
Which is what the Republicans own.
Right.
No one's ever been able to sort of make that connection, or that disconnect those connections.
I agree.
Which is interesting to me,
and
I think something we could accomplish.
I do too.
Except that Democrats never accomplished anything like this because they're useless.
No, they don't.
The big news today,
yes,
was that Obama, gay rights hero that he is busy drafting an executive order to end LGBT discrimination in the workplace.
Right. For federal contractors.
For federal contractors, right.
This is what he's been getting up to. He did it with the minimum wage.
He's up to a lot of federal contractor related.
Because that's basically what he can do without Congress is sort of like what happens with like federal workers.
Yeah.
So, and he has been sort of like, he's been urging Congress to pass ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, for like ages and ages. And all the gay rights groups have been like really on his ass for like not doing something himself.
It's passed in the Senate. It's just the House is...
Right, the House won't vote.
Obviously.
Right.
Where things
get
held up.
So, he finally decided to do it, basically. So, and this is great. I mean, this is going to make it, you know, illegal for employers nationwide to fire someone or harass them based on their sexual orientation or gender identity too,
which is probably the bigger sort of concern at this era at this point in time.
I think a lot of people are sort of like acknowledging that's like the next fight, and that I think
that was an issue that a lot of gay rights groups didn't even want to touch for a long time.
That's going to be a trickier one, I think, which is unfortunate. But I mean, like, you know, so it's
well, that was the big controversy with HRC. That was. Is that they?
Oh, right.
They wanted to sort of. They didn't want to deal with that.
Right.
They were.
Right.
Sort of,
they wanted to get gay married and then sort of
and
like,
then, like not
call it a day.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
But so this is going to be interesting to see how this affects. Well, we'll never pass ENDA.
not in this house. No.
Uh-uh. So nothing will happen. But it was, you know, his big gay pride.
It's Pride
moment.
Pride Month. Exactly. Which he's acknowledged. He sent out his, you know, annual Pride sort of message to everyone.
The DNC is having their Pride gala.
Right.
Because I think Pride is this weekend in New York.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
probably.
That's I was happy to have missed it because I thought that could have been a clusterfuck for my flying situation.
Oh, it would have been. Yeah. Yeah, would have made getting to the airport a real to-do. Yeah.
Or it wouldn't have been because New York is brilliant and I take the train to the airport.
That's true. Right. Maybe and you're already on Xanax anyway, so it's like...
It's like, what could have happened?
What was the worst that could have happened?
If the parade route had been between me and the train station, that could have been a catastrophe.
Yeah, exactly.
Luckily, that was not the case. Yeah. But in any case, that's, I think, happening this weekend in New York, so happy Pride, New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Being proud.
Oh, boy. In final news. Oh, man. We talked a couple weeks ago about the Republican primary in Iowa and Joni Ernst, who is the woman who won that race. She's run into some issues this week with her husband's Facebook page.
I mean.
And this could potentially be an issue for her because, like, BuzzFeed dug up some of these quotes from her husband's page. And, like, the Des Moines Register, which is, you know, I mean, like, it's the paper of record in Iowa. Yeah, like that's what you read
right
there.
That's the newspaper there.
Ran with this story and printed all this stuff, and she has really had to like go back on all this stuff. But like he has some pretty like crazy things on his Facebook page. He called Hillary Clinton a hag. He posted a picture of her and called her a hag.
This is a good example of things that get said to you when you're a woman.
Yes.
That are coded.
Right, exactly. He called Janet Napolitano a traitorous skank. And he also posted, like, some photo and, like, that was, like, some, like, joke, some sort of, like, you know, like, mass probably thing that, like, similar to what my dad is posting.
Yeah.
He wouldn't post this because it's insensitive, but, you know.
He's posting the non-insensitive version right, of these mass posts.
Yeah, it says, "What do you do if you see your ex running around in your front yard screaming and bloody? Stay calm, reload, and try again."
Ooh.
Isn't that hilarious? You're supposed to be shooting your ex-wife in the front yard. Like, that. First off, that's not funny.
No, it's not funny.
At all.
It's not even funny on the joke level.
No, that's what I mean. Like, even if it's, like, was...
if it conceptually was funny.
Right, because, I can get on board, potentially, with a joke about shooting your ex-wife.
Sure.
If, like, there's, like, a real good punchline in right. there someplace.
That's not that joke.
This is just not it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... Joni Ernst already running into trouble.
Yeah.
Like, I guarantee there's more coming.
Well, I think the funny thing about this is that, like, you know, we've had so many Republican candidates who have, like, had trouble with women's issues lately. And Iowa has never had, as we discussed, a statewide...
A female
elected official to a statewide office. And, like, it's sort of sad and also hilarious that, like... The woman candidate is getting hammered
with the same issues.
She's having the woman's problems.
Yeah.
Right now, like she's the Joni Ernst, the woman
is the one creating
the war on women right now.
Yeah. Typical. Typical totally, of a GOP woman to do that.
It is.
For God's sakes, people.
I mean, come on.
Get on board.
Right.
It's like.
Like don't have women problems.
First of all, don't be married to this guy.
If you're Joni, don't. Right.
Now, obviously, he's an asshole.
Totally. He's trying to shoot his ex-wife.
Right. That. You could potentially be that ex-wife right. one day. You don't want to be that.
No.
But yeah, that's typical. That's just
totally is.
Everything.
Yeah.
And in actual final news, Casey Kasem died.
We
don't have a story for that. But
this is the second week that we've ended with just like miscellaneous tragic. Because last week at the very end of the podcast, we were like, well, Tracy Morgan might die.
Tracy Morgan.
Right. And then we were like, okay, bye. This time someone did die. See you next week. No, I'm just kidding. But no, actually.
I mean, actually, because we don't have anything more to tell you after that.
He was 82, I think I read.
Yeah.
Also, I might have made that up just to add something so it seemed like we had information. Yeah. Might have been 117.
He was elderly, for sure. He had health problems. We knew that because that got reported a few weeks ago.
And there was a big situation with, I think there was a court case about whether he was going to be like taken off of his life support because like the family was fighting or something.
Yeah.
See, we know things.
We know things.
Yeah.
Idle news reading.
Just yeah, exactly.
Teaching us potentially false things.
We keep up for you.
That's right. For you.
We do it for you.
In any case, that is the final news of the week.
Yeah.
So we will see you next week at our regularly scheduled time again.
Yes.
And then you can be happy because for the summer, we'll just be like...
We're here.
We're podcasting at a normal time, usually. Yep. So that's fun.
That's it.
So in any case, have a good week.
Yeah, bye.